Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the just-elected Prime Minister of Israel backtracking on his last-minute election pledge to right-wing voters that there would never be a Palestinian state on Netanyahu's watch. Award-winning investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, the author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, joins us to discuss Netanyahu's flip-flopping and the warning by Britain that they would support a Palestinian state at the UN if Israel abandoned peace efforts with the Palestinians, a threat echoed in a similar statement by the White House. Then we will go to Germany, where anti-austerity riots at the opening of the new European Central Bank in Frankfurt resulted in the arrest of 500 Blockupy protesters and the burning of police cars. We will speak with former Financial Times correspondent Daniele Sforza, the director of the Europe program at the German Marshall Fund, about the makeup of the 10,000-strong demonstrations that included protesters from all over Europe as well as from Germany, whose rallying cry was, "They want capitalism without democracy. We want democracy without capitalism." Then finally, we will examine the idea of compulsory voting in America floated by President Obama at a town hall meeting in Cleveland. Myrna Perez, the director of the Voting Rights and Election Project at the Brennan Center for Justice, who works on voting rights issues such as redistricting, list maintenance, and access to the ballot, joins us to discuss Obama's suggestion of compulsory voting made in the context of counteracting the growing role of money in politics that 26 countries have adopted, where turnout is over 90% compared to the 37% of eligible voters who participated in the 2014 midterm elections. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And already, Prime Minister Netanyahu is of Israel, who just was newly re-elected for a fourth term, making him the longest-serving Israeli prime minister. He's already backtracked on his promise that he would never establish a Palestinian state on his watch. In an interview with Andrea Mitchell of NBC News, he's sort of saying that I don't want a one-state solution, I want a sustainable, peaceful two-state solution. So what's your sense of whether or not this political leader who's never particularly been enthusiastic about a Palestinian state, whether people are going to believe the former or the latter?
Well, of course he's going to try to repair the damage he's done by coming on an American network as his first interview and making this disingenuous statement about his desire for a two-state solution. But Netanyahu has never sought such a thing, and we have to understand what it is that he wants, and we have to understand what it is that the Jewish-Israeli public wants and why they elected him. First off, Netanyahu has said repeatedly, and the American media has ignored it, and his defense minister, who's one of his closest allies, Moshe Yaalon, has said this. What they want is occupation maintenance. They don't want to annex all of the West Bank. They want to keep the status quo going for as long as possible and maintain the occupation. They want to keep Gaza under siege, and they expect the U.S. to assist them. So in a sense, he doesn't want a one-state solution where Israel annexes all of the West Bank and declares officially apartheid. I mean, that would be stupid. But what he wants to do is keep the occupation going indefinitely with the PA, the Palestinian Authority, acting as his occupation subcontractor. Now, as for what the Israeli public wants, Netanyahu understands because he's part of the Israeli public and he was raised in this comprehensively racist, militaristic society, and he's a product of it, that most Jewish Israelis do not want to live beside a viable Palestinian state, nor do they want to live next door to a Palestinian or an African migrant, for that matter. And that's what he told them in his last-minute appeal. He said, "Buses full of Arabs are coming to vote at the election polls. Come out and vote for me." And he declared that he will never give land to Palestinians. So the real Netanyahu lifted his mask, and the real Israel showed itself to the world by electing him. It's time for Americans to understand that this is what Israel wants and that this is what Israel is. It doesn't want a Palestinian state, and it's Israelis who will have to vote for any two-state solution in the Knesset, and it will never happen.
So in this same interview with Andrea Mitchell on NBC on Thursday, she asked Netanyahu whether or not to respond to allegations that he is a racist. And Netanyahu simply said, "I'm not." I take it you don't believe that.
Well, having been, you know, screamed at by Andrew Breitbart in CPAC because I called him and his operation racist, I think that no one will admit that they're racist anymore these days. I think, you know, white supremacists claim that they're white rights activists or European rights activists. So Netanyahu's whole language is consistent with that. But Netanyahu's someone who, in his first book, A Durable Peace, warned that the creation of a Palestinian state would lead Latinos who are citizens of the United States to secede and form a separate Latino republic in the southwestern United States. I mean, this guy's as racist as you can get. And he's the product of a society that's constructed on a system of racism, which outcasts Palestinians simply because they're not Jewish. I mean, the essence of the Jewish state is fundamentally ethnocratic. So we can't be seeing Netanyahu as some kind of anomaly in this society. He's just someone who's lifted the mask, who's easily identifiable as a racist, and he doesn't cater to the kind of sensibilities of American liberals or the Democrats who are in power in the White House. And that's really what's creating this diplomatic crisis. But I mean, had the Zionist Union been elected, you would have had a much friendlier face enacting many of the same policies. We have to remember that Herzog and Livni, the two leaders of the Zionist Union, were quite content with bombarding the Gaza Strip. They were quite happy with 590 child casualties in the last war last summer. So I think Netanyahu being reelected is in a way positive for diplomacy, because now we can start seeing some real pressure come down on Israel.
Well, that's what the U.S., the White House has already hinted at. The press secretary said that the U.S. would reevaluate our position and the path forward in this situation and might even explore pressing for Palestinian statehood at the United Nations. And they also, in regard to the Arab vote and Netanyahu's warning to supporters that Arab voters are going to go to the polls in droves, the White House spokesman said, "Rhetoric that seeks to marginalize one segment of their population is deeply concerning, as it is divisive. And I can tell you that these are views the administration intends to communicate directly to the Israelis." So what's your sense then, Max Blumenthal, of whether or not that will be in effect Obama's revenge, that they will stop, the U.S. will stop vetoing all these resolutions at the U.N. in the sense that Israel's last defense is always a U.S. Veto, and allow the U.N. to go ahead with Palestinian statehood?
Well, first off, I think that when you see the White House criticizing Netanyahu openly, the opinion of grassroots Democrats of Israel itself drops, and we've seen that in recent polls in the last year. Grassroots Democrats, rank-and-file Democrats, opinion of Israel has dropped 10 points. There's no majority in support of Israel over the Palestinians within the Democratic Party anymore. The base of pro-Israel support in the U.S. is now the Republican Party, and that trend will intensify. On the question of Palestinian statehood, I think the U.S.'s idea of Palestinian statehood is more along the lines of the Clinton parameters than something that the Palestinian Authority or the PLO is offering. And what the U.S. might seek to do at the U.N. is introduce a resolution that would place the major settlement blocks, the Israeli settlement blocks that divide Jerusalem from the West Bank, that sit on top of the Palestinian aquifer, make those settlement blocks part of a permanent state of Israel, on the grounds that Israel swaps some land with the Palestinians, and we don't know where that land could be. This resolution could basically delete Resolution 242, which calls for Israel to pull back to 67 lines. So it could actually be a dangerous resolution. Finally, I don't expect the U.S. to start allowing, for example, resolutions to go through from the Palestinian side that will allow them to take Israel to the International Criminal Court. I just don't see that happening. So from my standpoint, what the change we're seeing right now is more rhetorical from the Obama administration, and it will have an effect on American public opinion in a pretty dramatic way.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. So some commentators are suggesting that maybe Netanyahu's election may not be a bad thing after all, because it will hasten the day of reality and the day of reckoning, if you will, in terms of Likud's rendezvous with destiny, in the sense that Vladimir Lenin, in the desperate Tsarist Russian times during World War I, said, the worse, the better. So is that a cynical possibility out there?
Well, I don't look at it from Leninist or Marxist perspective. I mean, I am a Marxist, but I'm only a Groucho Marxist. And, you know, the question now is, as Groucho Marx said, who are you going to believe, me or your two lying eyes, when it comes to the question of Israeli apartheid? I mean, Israel has enacted a system of apartheid. It's been going on for decades. We've seen very little change on the ground. All we've seen is expansion of Israeli settlements, wars on largely defenseless civilian Palestinian population grow more and more disproportionate and intense, with very little accountability for the Israeli government. And what we're seeing, you know, where you are in California, is a majority of UC campuses passing divestment resolutions to divest from companies involved in the Israeli occupation. These are initiatives enacted by the Students for Justice in Palestine group on campus. And this is one of the only avenues I can see for putting pressure on the Israeli government. When you start seeing, you know, mainstream liberals and the Obama administration echo the kind of language we've been seeing on UC campuses about Israel, when you see John Kerry last year warning that Israel was galloping towards apartheid, it's because of Netanyahu. It's because Netanyahu has universal name recognition. He speaks without shame about what he seeks to do to Palestinians. He speaks without shame about rejecting the two-state solution. And in this sense, it's a good thing, because he's mobilizing pressure. He's not as smart as we give him credit for. The people around him who engineered this speech in Congress are actually pretty stupid. And so, I mean, if you are an opponent of the occupation, you necessarily are an opponent of the special relationship, which has protected the occupation. And Netanyahu has been, in fact, a godsend for those who seek to roll back the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. Having said that, Ian, I think Netanyahu can do a lot of damage. I think that he is inspiring Islamophobia around the world. He seeks to resurrect this clash of civilizations narrative, which puts Muslim life in danger, particularly in Europe. I was just in Europe, just in France, and Islamophobia is on overdrive. And I think Jews in Europe are in an incredibly precarious position as a result of this. So Netanyahu can play a very destabilizing role on the world stage. But from an American perspective, I prefer him there than someone who speaks, in a more sophisticated way, but continues to maintain the occupation.
Well, surely Islamophobia is also being spread, I think, far more effectively by the Islamic State and by their beheading people and by the attack on Charlie Hebdo in Paris. I mean, I don't think Netanyahu holds a candle to those people.
I see the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant in a de facto coalition with the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, and both seek to resurrect this clash of civilizations, to act it out, and both benefit from it, and neither have any inherent conflict with one another, which is why we don't see them coming into conflict, and why we actually see Israel treating fighters from the Nusra Brigade, which is aligned with Al-Qaeda. And there is absolutely no conflict between Netanyahu's Israel and Baghdadi's ISIS.
So let's turn to the likely outcome of Netanyahu's victory here in the U.S. Congress, given the alliance between the Republicans and Likud has been pretty clear. They invited him over behind the backs of the Democrats and the White House. 47 of them wrote that letter that was obviously organized by Bill Kristol through this surrogate he has, this fellow Tom Cotton down there in Arkansas, who just got elected. So what more mischief can the Likud Republican coalition get up to in terms of trying to stitch up Obama?
Well, Tom Cotton has proven to be about as deft and sophisticated as previous Chris Tools, as I call them. We have to remember that Bill Kristol was the chief of staff to the intellectual icon, Vice President Dan Quayle. And after that, he sort of discovered Sarah Palin and became kind of a outside advisor to her on foreign policy. He likes to kind of rent the brains of people who have this deep ethereal void in their cranium because he can implant neoconservative ideas. So Tom Cotton is the latest Chris Tool. And I think Cotton's stunt, his letter to the Iranian leaders, has really benefited Obama. At every step of the way, Netanyahu has and his cutouts in Washington have helped Obama's push for detente with Iran, or entente. So I don't know what more damage they can do. I think they're actually damaging themselves quite a bit right now.
But if this deal with Iran is signed, which it appears to be very close to being signed, what can they do to stop it? On the one hand, you would think that once the deal is signed, and this is a deal with the P5 plus one, which is six of the world's powers, and then, of course, that has to be at least getting rid of the sanctions have to be ratified, and that's highly unlikely with this Congress, but that won't stop the rest of the world from lifting sanctions. And I think most people will recognize at the end of the day that peace is more beneficial to all than war. But then just the other day in the Washington Post, Joshua Muravchik,
Joshua Apparatchik.
Joshua Muravchik wrote this extraordinary op-ed basically saying that we should go to war with Iran and destroy Iran's nuclear infrastructure. And if that doesn't succeed, we should keep bombing it until it does succeed. So he was talking not about bombing Iran, but bombing Iran as often as necessary.
Yeah, he called it the least bad option. I mean, it's kind of like, you're talking to a doctor about how to cure a cold or something. It's like a pretty decadent statement. We have to remember that, first of all, most Americans support this deal with Iran. And I don't think that the neoconservatives have any way of changing that. However, we have to remember that Netanyahu attempted another election season stunt that's been sort of forgotten. Which is that he assassinated or orchestrated an attack on a Hezbollah convoy that contained the son of the assassinated Hezbollah leader, Imad Mughniyeh. Hezbollah retaliated and attacked an Israeli convoy pretty effectively. Hezbollah, which is armed by Iran and Russia, which has anti-tank Cornet missiles, has a far greater strategic deterrent capacity than Hamas does, and so Netanyahu and the Israeli army chiefs didn't choose to retaliate because one more retaliation would have led to a war on the northern border. But Avigdor Lieberman, who's currently the foreign minister, has said that a third war on the northern border with Hezbollah is inevitable, and this is something that Netanyahu could do: start a war with Iran's leading proxy in the Middle East. And that would have serious implications for a deal with Iran. And I wouldn't put it past him. That's the only scenario I can see that could potentially upend this kind of diplomacy.
Well, it's always been understood that if Israel were to attack Iran, which is not very likely or not very doable in any way that would be significant, nevertheless, in order to attack Iran, you would have to neutralize Hezbollah first, because that's Iran's ace in the hole in terms of retaliation. So That's an extension of the of an already existing understanding, surely.
Right. So we're talking about at least a proxy war with Iran. I think Israel's reluctant to do it because, according to the army's own assessment, Hezbollah has the capacity to temporarily seize towns on the northern border that are Israeli towns. The Israeli army, especially its ground forces, have proven incredibly weak over the last decade. So I think they're reluctant to do it. But Netanyahu and his inner circle have proven to be quite willing to destabilize the regional situation to get what they want, and they've been threatening to do so. Another factor is that Israel's been seeking airfields in Azerbaijan because they don't have in-air refueling capacity that would allow them to launch sorties directly against Iran. And they may have received those airfields. In 2012, the Obama administration shipped 18,000 GBU bunker buster bombs to Israel to mollify Netanyahu against attacking Iran. But these bunker busters, combined with the airfields in Azerbaijan, could allow Israel to attack Iran directly in an Oserac-style attack. And we have to remember who engineered the Oserac attack on the Iraqi reactor in 1982. It was Richard Perle, a low-level defense official in the Reagan administration. So the neoconservatives have had this up their sleeve for a long time, and I wouldn't put anything past them.
Well, just in closing, Max Blumenthal, in terms of going forward, obviously we're going to have a kind of continuing gridlock and poisonous relationship between the White House and the Republicans, who will be more and more aligned with Netanyahu and Likud. But at the end of the day, after Obama's gone, you're either going to have a Republican president who would be completely friendly to Netanyahu, or you'll have Hillary Clinton, who most people think, even though she personally doesn't like Netanyahu, and I don't think any world leader does, that she would be more friendly towards Netanyahu's policies than Obama.
Well, We're going to see this relationship between right-wing controlled Israel and the U.S. really dominate 2016 elections, and this is really thanks to the Likudnik warlord Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire casino baron, who is basically Netanyahu's top sugar daddy. But is also one of the leading contributors to American politics and history, and one of the top contributors to the Republican Party, exert his influence in 2016 to ensure that someone, a Republican who's friendly to Netanyahu, gets in the White House. Someone who he's funding right now, quietly, and this hasn't been widely reported, is Scott Walker from Wisconsin. And so Adelson is hedging his bets. I mean, he could easily go with someone like Chris Christie, who I think has been basically discredited as a candidate. But Adelson is also heavily funding Scott Walker, and Scott Walker is taking an increasingly neoconservative line. We'll see in the Republican primary candidates compete to kiss Adelson's ring and compete for his money with incredibly Islamophobic and anti-Palestinian statements. And then you'll see Hillary Clinton, I think, reassuring her donors like Haim Saban. It was recently reported that Hillary Clinton's been traveling on Haim Saban's private jet. And Saban is one of the top donors to the Israel lobby. He's a close friend. He's a friend of Sheldon Adelson. Him and Adelson actually recently in D.C., at an event in D.C., were both boasting about how they'd considered buying the New York and L.A. Times. To affect a more pro-Israel line at both papers. So you'll see Hillary Clinton reassuring her donors by talking about her desire to repair relations with Israel. But once the reality sets in, if a Hillary Clinton administration takes power in Washington, they're going to sound a lot like Obama does. because they're going to be treated the same way by Israel as Obama. They're going to be receiving the same intelligence assessments from the CIA and the same reports from the State Department about all the damage that Israel's doing in the region, and they're going to have to act accordingly. And as far as I know, Hillary Clinton is just as big of a fan as Obama is of the Pivot East strategy, which is something that the Israel lobby fears and will do anything to forestall.
Well, Max Blumenthal, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal. He's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. We're going to take a brief station break and go to Germany to look into the anti-austerity riots at the opening of the new European Central Bank. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniela Schwarzer, who's the director of the Europe program at the German Marshall Fund. Previously, she was a journalist with the Financial Times, and she's also a senior research professor at the Department of European and Eurasian Studies at Johns Hopkins University. She's the co-founder and co-editor of the European Political Economy Review and the www.eurozonewatch.eu website. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniela Schwarzer.
Hello, Ian.
And these riots that took place in Frankfurt at the opening of the new European Central Bank, a building that, by the way, cost $1.4 billion, resulted in about 500 arrests and burning police cars. What's the response been in Germany?
Well, first of all, people were completely surprised, as was the Frankfurt police, by the way, about the degree of violence that showed on the streets in Frankfurt yesterday. So there was a general, you know, surprise and, of course, many questions. Why does this happen this way? How could it happen? And, of course, now a lot of analysis is being done. Who were those people who came to Frankfurt? And one interesting thing was there were Germans, of course, but there was essentially a European movement towards Frankfurt. So it was engaged civil society activists from a number of European Union member states who came to Frankfurt to protest. And then, obviously, there was a small group of protesters who were ready to engage in that kind of violence, which pictures showed around the world. But the majority of demonstrators were actually left-wing civil society movements who protest against the austerity policy that has been implemented in a number of European member states since the crisis broke out. And so what we see here beyond the protest is really a very interesting trans-European solidarity movement, and for the first time it happens on Germany's territory.
And the rallying cry apparently was, they want capitalism without democracy. We want democracy without capitalism.
Yes, that takes it to the extreme. I think what has shown in Frankfurt yesterday, but also in the recent elections, such as in Greece, where left-wing extremist movements actually got into power, that people are completely frustrated both with their national elites and also with Europe. So there's truly a problem of democratic legitimacy, because a number of member states who have lived under IMF and EU financial aid programs, who had to fulfill substantially detailed conditionality, hence had to deliver on budgetary cuts and structural reforms, in those countries, voters have the feeling they go to elections, they vote, people may change, but policies don't. So this movement in Frankfurt yesterday was one way to express that frustration.
And the Syriza party apparently had some representatives in the demonstration, as did Spain's Podemos party. And obviously there's been a lot of theatre, if you will, between the new Greek finance minister and the German official with whom he's negotiating. They're certainly, they did not look like, from the body language, that they were having a good time.
There's a huge dispute going on between Athens and Berlin, of course. Berlin is not negotiating anything officially with Athens. This is, of course, Brussels. It is the head of the Eurogroup, it is the European Commission, and it's also the International Monetary Fund, because those are the bodies that have given credit to Greece and that are now trying to push the government towards reform. But Germany is in the new European rescue mechanisms, which have been created since the crisis broke out. Germany is the largest contributor, with 27% of guarantees and money poured into those mechanisms. So the German voice counts a lot. And the conflict between Berlin and Athens has reached a public degree of, you know, of fighting, of polarization, of criticism, which is so far unseen in the European Union.
Now, in terms of what the besieged head of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, who was in the building on the day that it was opened. It's been operating since November, but yesterday was a big ceremony, and Mario Draghi gave a speech marking the inauguration, and he felt that it's not a fair charge to blame the ECB for the unpopular austerity in Europe. And he said that we have to listen to the people. What do you make of that? Because didn't the original loans to both Spain and Greece largely come from commercial banks?
Yes, there was a lot of bank lending, of course, to Greece and also Spain and other countries, which then went through crisis. But I think Mario Draghi is right in one point. The ECB takes the blame for policy choices imposed on governments, but in fact, the ECB doesn't really have stakes in those negotiations because it hasn't provided credit to governments. It can't even. It's excluded from, you know, by the European Union Treaty and by its statutes. But it has, of course, played a big role in financial surveillance and still does. And it is also, you know, the institution responsible for European monetary policy. So it is necessarily part of the institutions that have managed the crisis in the euro area. But in particular on the design of budgetary policy choices and structural reforms, the European Central Bank of the three parties, European Commission and IMF and European Central Bank, which are united in the so-called Troika, it is really the party that is the least to blame because its mandate is focused on monetary policy and it is also mandated to monitor financial stability. And in fact, Mario Draghi, he has been among those who has pushed European governments to do more in crisis management. He has said the European Central Bank can't do it all. Governments have to help other governments. So it is, in a way, for me, it's a crystallization point of that protest, which is, yes, the ECB is part of the institutions that are responsible for the whole rescue policy, but of the three, again, I think it is the one that is the least to blame.
But the Troika, nevertheless, does basically set the conditions for the bailouts in Ireland, Greece, Portugal, and Cyprus. And I guess at the heart of the sense of unfairness that led to these 10,000 protesters showing up in Frankfurt yesterday at the opening of the new European Central Bank is to do with the idea that lenders can be irresponsible. They can make bad loans, as we saw here in the United States with the housing market crashing in 2008 and almost bringing down the global economy. The bankers who make bad loans don't get so much punished as the countries who receive the loans and the politicians who negotiate the loans you know, obviously they all got thrown out in Greece. So do you see that as a sort of inherent unfairness, that there's no penalty for irresponsible lending, but there is a penalty for irresponsible borrowing?
Yes, and that's a problem which, you know, has accompanied the debate in Europe since 2010, since the Greek sovereign debt crisis hit and it spread to other countries. And also in that regard, it's not only blame put on banks, but also in a way blame put on Germany, because much of the lending to Greece came from Germany. So the countries in crisis, and in particular those who feel they bear the largest burden, in particular, you know, taxpayers and citizens of those countries, they say the costs of dealing with the crisis have been very unequally distributed. So it's the citizens who can't move away from the countries, who live there, who don't have a perspective, who are actually burdened with the costs of adaptation, while the banks have all pulled out. If Greece now goes bankrupt, they don't bear any of the costs anymore. So it's basically the European Central Bank and a few others who would actually have losses, but those who were part of the build-up of the problem in the country, they have long left. So there is some truth to that, and we definitely have had over the last 4 years a very one-sided debate, but the way this is now framed by the protesters is, of course, a very fundamental criticism of capitalism, which in my personal view goes too far in many ways.
And what do you think how far do you think that resonates in Germany and in Europe itself, since this demonstration seemed to be a kind of pan-European demonstration?
It resonates in particular in the crisis countries, but interestingly, demonstrators went on television in Germany or, you know, were interviewed for newspapers saying, we feel a huge sense of solidarity with the Greeks and with others. And that is a tone which we haven't heard a lot over the last 4 years. Mainly media reporting on German reactions to Greece is about a loss of trust and no more confidence that the Greek government is actually serious about reforms and that they take our credit but do not behave responsibly. So I think these are new tones. It is interesting to see how, this took place in Germany because the ECB is there, but there were many, many German demonstrators. And that is something where maybe the political left now wakes up and says, maybe we need to have a voice in that debate from a non-crisis country, which is actually on the lending side, because there is a very broad degree of realization that the policies imposed on the countries over the last 4 years haven't really brought the economic success that was expected. And with the election of Syriza and with the sort of protest potential that comes with that election, people start to realize that the social and political costs of pressuring governments to reform and cut budgets too quickly is very, very high and actually risks or puts at risk the stability in the European Union.
Well, what did you know about Blockupy, the Blockupy movement, before this demonstration in Frankfurt?
They have been in the news for probably 2 weeks, in the sense of they were starting to voice criticism. They had a first public exchange with the European Central Bank a week back. And so they were present, and the ECB is probably one of the institutions that realized one has to have a dialogue with them. But this definitely came too late. So they organized the demonstration in Frankfurt, and then with that, you know, actually nonviolent approach they have because they wanted to demonstrate, came that crowd of protesters who were actually ready to burn cars and tires and throw stones. And that obviously harms the image of the NGO. But it is an organization which, yeah, I would say since, for a few weeks now has made it into the press. So the name is now known, unfortunately now connected to the violence that happened on Frankfurt Street.
So how do you think this might impact this coalition government that Angela Merkel has? Do you think the left part of that government would be influenced in any way? Would the protesters be a grassroots sort of fire, if you will, that's lit under their feet?
Not for the time being. And one of the reasons is that we have another movement in Germany which is gaining ground, and that is a Eurosceptic party called the Alternative for Germany, which is basically Eurocritical because it says the currency brings together a bunch of countries that don't really match and one should better let Southern Europe go, of course, in particular Greece. And this party actually has gained ground in recent regional elections, and if you look at the voter composition, it's very clear that it takes away voters both from the Conservatives, the CDU, but also from the Social Democrats, the SPD. And because of that trend, that Social Democrats do not diverge that much from the Conservatives on economic and budgetary policy issues, and apparently they are threatened by this new right-wing movement, which is against a big monetary union, they are not very prone to influence from the new left NGO Blockupy. So for the time being, I don't think that's the party or the movement that will impact their policy positions.
Well, there's obviously been a lot of alarm expressed about the growing right-wing parties in Europe, many of which, by the way, are financed by Vladimir Putin, which, you know, Jobbik in Hungary and Le Pen's party in France. And that is something that there's been a lot of concern expressed about. What's your thoughts on that? Do you think there's any way that, I mean, they're Eurosceptic, but how do you distinguish between those kind of right-wing parties and this Eurosceptic party that you just told us about?
I think they converge on many points. One of them is an anti-immigration stance. Another one is the criticism of the euro. And then there is obviously the question of positioning on Russia. And here we can indeed see that also within the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD, there are voices who actually say, no, well, we have to understand Putin's approach and we have to see that we actually, you know, provoked a reaction from Russia by our approach to Ukraine and neighboring countries. So there is indeed a parallel between this right-wing movement in Germany and others. And as you said, the big danger is that Putin actually exploits that political and economic situation in the European Union. Because of 7 years of crisis since the financial crisis first spilled into the EU in 2007, there is, of course, low growth, high unemployment in a number of member states. So there's political instability. The fringes have gained ground, and those parties are open to accepting money from Russia. So there is a pretty easy way of Putin to pay his way into influencing domestic politics in the European Union. And that is a huge challenge because, of course, the European Union will have to continue to struggle for a common position on Russia when it comes to the next decision on sanctions, for instance. And here I would say the political polarization we are witnessing and the emergence of new actors actually opens doors for Putin's influence in the European Union.
Well, Daniela Swarcza, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniela Swarcza, who's the director of the Europe Program at the German Marshall Fund and a senior research professor at the Department for European and Eurasian Studies at Johns Hopkins University. She's a former journalist with the Financial Times and is the co-founder and co-editor of the European Political Economy Review and the www.eurozonewatch.eu website. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into the idea of compulsory voting in America floated by President Obama. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mona Perez, who's the director of the Voting Rights and Election Project at the Brennan Center for Justice, focusing on a variety of voting rights-related issues, including redistricting, list maintenance, and access to the ballot box. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mona Perez.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's good to be back.
And the president on Wednesday, during a town hall meeting in Cleveland, floated the idea of making voting in America compulsory. It was sort of off the cuff and in response to and in the context of money dominating our politics. But there are 26 countries in the world that have compulsory voting, and some, like Australia and Belgium, enact a fine. And frankly, in the United States, in the last election, only 37% of eligible voters took part in the 2014 midterms. So what's your response in terms of the voting landscape? Is this a dead letter, or is this the beginning of an important discussion?
Well, we do have a lot of people who should be participating in our elections that aren't. And President Obama is correct that the country needs to take big steps to boost turnout in this country. Mandatory voting is certainly a bold idea that hasn't been explored yet. But there is a very tangible, real problem. And that's there are a lot of people in this country who want to participate but can't. They're being blocked by new voting restrictions or stymied by our ramshackle registration system.
So, but the president is right in saying that money is taking over our politics. It's absolutely clear, is it not?
Certainly money is playing an enormous role in our politics, and the voices of average Americans are having a hard time being heard at the ballot box. One should not forget the fact, though, that there are politicians around the country who are trying to manipulate the rules of the game such that some people can participate and some people can't. We see them passing unfair voting laws that keep people from the polls, and instead what they should be doing is trying to work on our voter registration system so that we can be having reforms that would make it easier for people to participate and to vote.
So I guess there's a distinction then between making it easier to vote and making it compulsory to vote.
That's certainly a distinction. And again, you know, we are at a time in our country where we should be looking at, why is it that people are not participating? And we should be having the conversations necessary to make those changes. There are far too many Americans who are not on the registration rolls. We think that there are steps that can be taken to do that. Oregon is one of those states that has recently taken steps. Your audience may have heard that the governor just signed into law a really groundbreaking policy which would move the burden of registering voters more on the states. What they're going to do is when eligible Americans go to the DMV to get their driver's license numbers, if they have demonstrated that they are eligible because they're the right age and that they're citizens, that information will be sent over to election offices who will then put the voters on the registration rolls unless the voter says, you know what, don't go register me. Most states in the country do it the other way. They ask the voter to affirmatively say that they want to be registered. And in Oregon, if you go to the DMV's office, they're going to put you on the rolls unless you say that you don't. And that is going to be helpful because once the folks are on the registration rolls, the self-interest of parties and other groups trying to do GOTV kick in, and they will go out and get those voters engaged.
So the parties will come to you.
Well, either the parties or, community groups or whoever it is that is working on voter engagement, they will know who the target is to try and become more active and involved. You know, the first step in voting is getting registered. And if people haven't taken that step, then it's really hard to get them involved later in the process. But once they're registered, they're constantly getting phone calls from people encouraging them to go out to vote. You know, people are knocking on their door. People are asking them, sending them mailers because they want them to participate. There are other steps that are being taken. And what we would like to happen is that all states look at ways in which they could modernize how it is that they do voter registration. And one of the things that states should be working toward is something like Oregon, which takes some of the responsibility for voter registration and and puts that on the state. So the state is assuming that responsibility rather than putting it on the voter.
And again, I'm speaking with Myrna Perez, who's the director of the Voting Rights and Election Project at the Brennan Center for Justice, where she focuses on a variety of voting rights related issues, including redistricting, list maintenance, and access to the ballot. And in suggesting compulsory voting, did so in the context of speaking about ways to counteract the role of money in politics. And just quoting what the president said, Myrna, quote, "That would counteract money more than anything. If everybody voted, then it would completely change the political map in this country, because the people who tend not to vote are young, they're lower income, they're skewed more heavily towards immigrant groups and minority groups, and they're often the folks who are they're scratching and climbing to get into the middle class. And they're working hard, and there's a reason why some folks try to keep them away from the polls. We should want to get them into the polls." You know, that's not exactly radical rhetoric.
No, I mean, I think there's very little disagreement that we as a country don't have all of our eligible Americans participating, and that our country would be more robust, our democracy would be more robust and participatory if it reflected all of the voices in our communities. And I think the president is calling for serious exploration of bold issues to try and transform that. You know, he mentioned the idea of compulsory voting. I would like for the country to also consider things like, you know, what sort of barriers politicians are putting in front of the ballot box, like, you know, overly stringent photo ID laws, cutbacks to early voting, burdensome documentary proof of citizenship requirements, restrictions on groups who are trying to register community members, laws disenfranchising people who are living and working in our community but have criminal convictions in their past. There are a lot of barriers to the ballot box from a lot of in front of a lot of Americans, and I think there's a lot we can do. A very easy way to get at some of that is to tackle our registration system, which is too dependent upon paper, really inefficient, and doesn't leverage the technology available. And there are ways that we can fix that, and we can see examples of states doing that with their adoption of online registration or their adoption of systems that electronically transfer data instead of trying to make all of it be contingent upon paper forms. And then again, like we saw Oregon take another example. And I think, you know, now is a good time in our country's history, especially since we're celebrating, you know, the anniversary of Selma, and we are on our way to another presidential presidential election cycle. This is a good time for us to be starting to take a hard look under the hood and figure out what it is that we can do to make our democracy stronger.
Well, Myrna Perez, Australia has compulsory voting and you get fined if you don't vote. But just based upon the last election, it's very clear that it does force politicians to basically enact policies or promote policies that they may not otherwise do. For example, the current Prime Minister of Australia, who was recently voted by Foreign Policy as the worst foreign leader in history, I think almost, a very conservative, a global warming denier in a country most affected by global warming. And he ran, nevertheless, as a conservative, but he ran on a platform of 6 months fully paid pregnancy leave for all Australian women and their significant others. And needless to say, he reneged on it as soon as he got elected. But the fact that a very conservative prime minister ran on a very liberal platform that even Democrats in this country wouldn't embrace, I think tells you a lot, doesn't it?
I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at, but I would say that having politicians know that there will be some level of accountability at the ballot box is likely to have a more is likely to cause politicians to take more representative views of what his or her constituency will look at, which is part of the reason why I think it's so important that there not be unnecessary barriers to the ballot box.
Well, what I was getting at was that a conservative nevertheless had to reach out to the broadest constituency to get elected with a very populist and popular issue. And it seems to me that that tells you as a voter that if you want to be taken care of by your government, you vote because the transaction is much clearer. The quid pro quo is much clearer. Does that make sense?
It certainly makes sense that when politicians believe that they will be held accountable at the polls, that they need to have policies that are more representative of what the constituency is discussing.
Well, just in closing, Myrna Perez, there obviously will be objections to the president's suggestion or proposal here about compulsory voting in the United States, and presumably the libertarians would find that onerous and perhaps unconstitutional. But surely if you could make voting easier, for example, if you could do it online or do it by mail, I don't see a great imposition on a citizen's freedom. If you have the choice to vote and you simply have to click a button, you know, saying, yes, I'll go ahead and vote, or no, I don't want to vote for anybody on whatever grounds that you have. So you have the freedom to reject the vote, but at least acknowledge that you got the ballot. That's not much of an imposition, particularly if you could mail it back or just send it back electronically, assuming that we evolve into the electronic age.
Well, we Ian, can spend an entire session talking about the pros and cons of voting by mail, and your audience would, I think, blow up all the phone lines if we willy nilly endorsed a policy of internet voting. There are a lot of security and other restrictions that need to be thought through before something like that could happen on any significant large scale. But what I do think is important, to take away from this conversation is that there are too many unnecessary barriers to the ballot box. It is too hard to register to vote. And instead of politicians trying to manipulate the rules of the game such that some people are participating and some people aren't, we should be looking for ways in a bipartisan manner that all sorts of eligible Americans are participating. I think our country will be stronger if we have more of its voices reflected, and I think there are far too many Americans who are eligible to vote but are not voting for a whole bunch of reasons, and some of those we can fix.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Myrna Perez.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Myrna Perez, who's the director of the Voting Rights and Election Project at the Brennan Center for Justice, where she focuses on a variety of voting rights-related issues, including redistricting, list maintenance, and access to the ballot box. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.